Good morning, everybody. This is The Conversation, and my name is John Stevenson. I'm filling in for John Orr today. The phone number here is area 503-325-0010, and we'd love to hear from you. Because the show today will also have a historical context, I'd love to hear from listeners that want to set the historical record right, if I get it wrong, or if you believe that the historical record is a salient point to our topic. Our topic today is American democracy, and we'll be talking about it from its technical standpoint. Democracy, its most simple definition, is the election of leaders by the people. There's a lot of permutations in that system. One would be that we elect representatives to do our voting for us, but essentially it's the voice of the people, which is what defines democracy. So I'd like to talk about, in America, some of the threats to direct democracy. And you may have opinions that these are good things or bad things, but in any event, it is these items which I'm going to list are indeed threats or anti-democratic initiatives. One is the Electoral College. Another is gerrymandering. Another is recent initiatives on term limits. And we can include voter suppression, money, and America's voter turnout as less direct threats to democracy. 503-325-0010 if you'd like to weigh in. We'll start with the Electoral College, and should it stay or should it go? And its original intent was a clear threat to direct democracy in that the will of the people would be sublimated to smart white men who would do the electing. No women, no blacks, and I believe at the time that it was landowners only. Feel free to call in and correct me on that if that's not right. John Adams, the great founder, had a serious worry about mob rule. It may have been his experience in the Boston Massacre, but it's probably something that cost him the 1800 election, where Thomas Jefferson was more interested in direct democracy, and John Adams was cast as a monarchist. Moving forward into the last century, another purpose of the Electoral College came about, which was that smaller states with less electors needed to see the candidates and hear their points of view. And without the Electoral College, that may not happen. But in consideration of technology currently, I don't know that advantage holds up, given that most of us get our information from media and not necessarily in live performance by a candidate. Those have more been relegated to pep rallies rather than a discussion of the issues. 503-325-0010. Let me know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think the question that we're asking in the conversation right now is, does the Electoral College work? Why or why not? And that's what we want to hear from you. So give us a call, 503-325-0010. Let us know that whether you think that the Electoral College works for this country.
The other issue, or another example, is looking at other countries and how they have handled their technical democracy. And I think you'd find, it, particularly in Western Europe, that their form of democracy is more representative than ours. And they have also taken the money out. There's severe restrictions, I'm thinking of England, on the money spent and advertising for candidates. We, and that, I believe, is a focus of those countries trying to make their democracy better. It would seem that in our country, when we work on the technical democracy, that it's more about winning elections than it is about improving our technical democracy. I think about gerrymandering in that context, where the party in power has the authority to move districts around, voting districts, in a way that gives them an advantage in the election. Once again, it's not a democratic process, or it's not as democratic as setting up districts to be representative. There have been initiatives through the years for term limits, and voters become exhausted with representatives they don't like, and the idea of imposing term limits on their representatives is their solution to that. However, term limits are clearly not democratic. If they want to remove someone from office, they should vote them out. That would be the democratic process rather than term limits. Voter suppression is something that's in the news, that we make it difficult for eligible voters to cast their vote, whether that is most recently in the reduction of the hours that people are allowed to vote, polling places being removed or moved so that they're difficult to get to. And once again, that appears to be not about making democracy better, but about winning an election. Voter turnout in America has been, in the presidential election, somewhere between 50 and 60% historically, last 20 years, say. And with 40% of eligible voters not voting in the presidential elections, it doesn't bode well for our form of technical democracy with that many people not participating. And I'd like to get your point of view on that. And then we can talk about how money became so prevalent in elections. Maybe in the old days, that money was used as bribes, but currently it is used to sway opinion with virtually no limits on the amount of money that can be spent. Let me know what you think. 503-325-0010. And we can hit any of these topics that you choose to weigh in on.
That's right. This is a conversation, and it's not a conversation unless you call. So let us know what you think about our technical democracy. I think we can point to examples of voter suppression. We can point to examples of the need for campaign finance reform, and certainly issues around the Electoral College. So give us your input and join the conversation. 503-325-0010.
It would be interesting to get a point of view that supports something like the Electoral College, or supports money in elections, term limits, voter suppression. I don't know what those rationale would be, but if you've got a point of view that supports those things, we'd love to hear from you. Oregon and Washington, I believe, have done something that is clearly good for democracy, which is the way that we vote with the mail-in ballots. Makes it easier to get participation. No polling places that have to be traveled to. No voter suppression. And it appears to be gaining some momentum nationally that may be the best way to technically vote. We've got a caller now. Let's see what they have to say.
Welcome to the conversation. You're on the air.
Yes. I've been listening. This is a very important issue, especially with everything that's been going on recently. And here's a comment. The lack of of participation in this conversation says something just about the mindset of the public.
You mean lack of...
Tolerance.
Yeah. Well, it's a new show, and we do have a limited population, so we're optimistic that as the show develops and we get more people listening, that the calls will come in fast and furious.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. But, you know, it's still an observation. I mean, I listen to this station religiously. We've been members for years. And so when something pops up, it should catch your attention. I think that generally American citizens have little time for attention to these things.
If you take the two devils of that threaten democracy, which are apathy and ignorance, and we can discuss how prevalent those two, that two-headed monster is, but 40% of eligible voters not participating is a gross example of apathy. And if you think about ignorance, I don't mean stupidity. I mean ignorance as defined by having a lack of information. That seems to me to be a clear threat to our democratic system. And one of the great reasons for public education is to produce an informed electorate. So, you know, public education has a lot of purposes, but it does, if executed properly, give us more well-informed voters, particularly on history, civics, economics, those sorts of topics, which may not be deemed as necessary in today's public education system.
Well, that's for sure. You know, they when I was a kid, and I'm no longer a kid, I'm 72, but we had things like art was mandatory in junior high, and I believe high school, too. It was certainly there when you were in elementary school. You know, easels were covered with tempera paint. It was crazy. I think that the emphasis is on entertainment, and that just draws a lot of people. I guess I'm trying to say nicely, if as many people followed sports as they followed the important things in their lives, like elections, we'd be a whole lot better off.
And it seems to me to be so little to ask that, you know, you make the effort to be well-informed and form the opinions that you would vote on. It's not that much to ask. And again, that 40% number of non-participation just shouts at me that they would allow anything before they'd go vote.
You know, isn't it Australia that it's mandatory you vote, or you've got to vote?
I'm not sure, but I've heard of that somewhere, and I would have mixed opinions on that. The one would be, do you really want people that know nothing to go out and vote?
Well, that happens anyhow.
Yeah, I know. That's where I go back to public education and those topics that have been, those studies that have been relegated to something. I don't know what has substituted for civics and history, but something must have.
I think it's sports.
Could be.
I'm not sure. I don't mean to be so down on that, but I think we spend way too much time and money on it. But the other thing I wanted to ask was the Electoral College. I had this belief that I picked up a long, long time ago that it was there because there was isolated communities and they all meet at the courthouse or wherever they met, and they would say, do you want this guy? And so many hands would go up. And do you want that guy? And so many hands would go up. And then their representative, you know, would say, well, the majority votes this way, and take off on his pony, to go to some center or some place where these things were done and hand up his tally as a majority vote.
Yeah, I've heard that as a rationale as well. And I think it picked up steam, particularly in the 20th century, when the arguments against the Electoral College were gaining speed, that the rationale of smaller communities being left out of the process was a reason. But I in the context of 2018 and the advent of ready technology, it doesn't seem like you need to meet the candidates live in order to get their points of view any longer.
Right. That stopped in the mid-50s, actually, I would say.
Yeah, I think so. It's anyway, I think the Electoral College has a couple things going for it in terms of its removal. One is that it's part of the Constitution, and we're loath to evolve our Constitution. And the other is that the party in power has a definite advantage by having the Electoral College, and they would fight against anything that would change that.
So thank you so much to that caller for that call. We have another call coming in. It looks like, oh, nope, they're on hold. So we'll keep going. But that was a good call, good input. I do think that sports are the great distraction these days, and certainly overemphasized in school when you're there to learn rather than to compete.
Right. There are a couple of things that might emasculate the Electoral College a little bit. One is an Oregon initiative to where the electors would be required to vote in the presidential election to vote for the winner of the popular vote. So in Oregon, that wouldn't have made much difference in 2016, but if it was used in Texas, all of Texas would have had to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I believe that is still on the table with the state of Oregon.
We've got another caller. Welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. My name's Chuck, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A few points. First, the Electoral College, regardless of its idea for conception, at conception, it's no longer valid. We wouldn't have the presidents we have today were not for the Electoral College. Two, the two-party system, and it's time to put it away. California sort of adjusted for that in its the top two vote takers, regardless of party. It's just time for that to happen. And three, voter interest. I don't think it's so much they're ignorant or uninformed. I think they're weary. We've dragged out the election process so long, and that combined with the Electoral College makes them feel tired and hamstrung. That's all I have to say.
Well, that's a good point. That exhaustion, I just wonder if that isn't a manifestation of apathy and ignorance, though, where things like term limits are put forward. And I think voter weariness and exhaustion may be a driving force in wanting to have term limits.
But don't you think term limits are a product of too much money and too long of, the desire for term limits are a factor of too much money has been thrown into it. If I'm contributing to a candidate, it's easier to contribute to the candidate I know, so to speak, than the one I don't.
Right. You know, I think when you talk about the money in the elections, it's interesting to do a deeper dive on that and what the money is used for and its efficacy in persuading voters. I think you can go to the 2016 election where the Republican candidate spent far, far less than the Democratic candidate. He got his point across by being a newsmaker. Whereas the Democratic candidate spent money like crazy, but was still not persuasive enough. So that the use of money and what its purpose is in elections may be evolving, and it may not be what we thought it was in terms of how it persuades people.
And wouldn't an easy answer be simply to have all elections funded through our government, whichever government is, local, state, federal?
Well, I think you run into the Constitution. You probably would run into maybe that being seen as an abrogation of free speech. And it may not go anywhere for those reasons, but it certainly would be a useful topic. And there, again, in Western Europe, you can find examples of how they prohibit money and its use and its purpose. I'm thinking of Britain primarily, and if we have any people that know the technical aspects of how they elect people in Britain, maybe give us a call and let me know. But I believe that they can't put any money into the election until very close to the end.
And a short period of time for the election process, too, if you will, the candidate process.
Right.
Thank you for listening.
Sure, thank you.
Goodbye.
There's an initiative in Maine currently, which it's run by the Republican Party. The state is run by the Republican Party, but the initiative in Maine is called ranked voting. And essentially how it works is you rank your choices for any candidate, first, second, third, and on down the line. And then they go through an elimination process. So theoretically, it is possible for the person with the second most votes in this elimination process to be the first place winner. Again, I think that is something that's typically done in Europe, and it's a more fair form of democracy where everyone's voice is counted. You think about a Republican in Oregon in the presidential election. I would understand their apathy because their vote clearly doesn't matter because of the Electoral College. Or a Democrat in Alabama or Mississippi or Kansas, where the apathy may be a manifestation of the truth, which is their vote in the presidential election does not matter. And these things like what Maine is doing with the ranked voting, or what Oregon would like to see, where by law, they would force the electors, the representatives in the Electoral College, to vote for the presidential candidate that gets the most votes. We've got another call coming in.
Yeah, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to The Conversation on Coast Community Radio. Today, we've got John Stevenson hosting in place of John Orr. Thank you, John, for hosting today. And we look forward to having John Orr back in the chair next week. So thank you for tuning in. And we've got another caller. Thank you for calling The Conversation. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Gwen, and I kind of was working on a voter registration campaign this summer. And one thing voters don't know, especially about felons, and that felons have the right to re-register after they have served their time, and as long as they're not incarcerated, they can re-register in the state of Washington. What is true for Oregon? How does that work for Oregon, for felons? Do you know?
I don't know the answer. It seems to be something that's picking up momentum along the West Coast, so I would imagine if Washington has done it, that Oregon would be very interested in doing it as well, but I don't have a specific answer for you if that's the case.
Felons' voter rights are restored when they're released from their sentence.
In Oregon,
yeah.
Yeah, but and that's true for in Washington, but they have to re-register. So,
it does require re-registering.
In Oregon, too, huh?
Yes.
And that's a very... You know, I probably talked to, I don't know, 1,000 people this summer. And, you know, a lot of guys walk by me with their head down and no. And I sometimes think that they have that felony, maybe somewhere in their past and don't understand the new rules. It's kind of interesting that Florida has a big case going on now, a big, is it a resolution or something in this next election, where all, is it felons? Do you know about the Florida case?
I do not.
Oh, it's going to impact all felons in the state of Florida. They will have their rights restored if this passes, and it's like a million people. So it's a big, you know, anybody that's interested in working on this issue can call this, I don't know, probably look it up, and either donate or support with phone banking or whatever.
What do you think the two sides of that argument are? I would assume one side is that felons have committed a grievous crime, and it seems like their inability to vote would be a lasting punishment, a punishment that far outlasts their incarceration. And that's part of probably the initial deterrent to becoming a felon, is that you would never be able to vote again. And the other side, I'm not certain of, but it seems to be that it's more forgiving. But do you know the rationale why felons should be allowed to vote?
Well, you know, it's like Saudi Arabia. If you do something wrong, they cut off a finger. That's a lifelong sentence. Here we have prisons so that people can serve their sentence and rejoin society. So folks should have the right to reassimilate and participate.
Do you think the Republican Party sees felons voting as a threat to their majority? Do you think there's a political aspect that way?
I think anyone with diversity, any diversity, and it could be, felons and folks who are imprisoned are often suffer from many issues, and you know, like poverty is one. You know, people don't get incarcerated much if they're super rich and can buy their way into a good attorney. And so my guess would be that most of our incarcerated are poor or diverse.
I think that's valid. I think that is a consistent.
And poor and diverse are Republican.
Right. Yeah, so that may be getting at the bottom of the issue, is that...
It may be at the bottom of the immigration problem, too, because, you know, immigrants don't come across as being, they have needs. They are poor, and except, you know, the new policy, according to Republicans' proposal, is that only 30,000 new immigrants will be accepted next year.
Right.
And I can imagine it's not from our South American countries.
The issue to me is that has tremendous support in America. And I think, again, when you do a deeper dive into why that exists, you might find some unpleasant rationales amongst the people that are so enthusiastic about reducing immigration. And I've used the word deeper dive a few times, and I think that every voter should do that and get down to the bottom of what their particular candidate or party is after. You could say that Republicans want border security, and that's not too debatable. Border security seems rational. When you go a little bit deeper, why do they want to suppress certain types of people? Is it so they can win elections? And then go one step deeper in what do Republicans want to win elections for, and what is their purpose? Why is someone a Republican? Does it get down to that there's just more money available on that side? I don't know the answer to that. But one thing that voter education can do is give people the answers to those deeper questions of why someone is a Republican or a Democrat.
I'm on a college board, and I proposed a voter education program, but it is so hard to to call it nonpartisan, you know, for anyone sitting in the class. Anyone sitting in the class is going to, at this day and age, is going to be skeptical of where the information is coming from and which book we're using to describe history, unless it's straight constitutional. And then even so, look at our Supreme Court, where the straight constitutional is divided 5-4.
I know. It's the polarity and the complete disbelief in the information coming from one side or the other is a ghastly problem in America.
I saw an interesting program. I don't watch it very often, but Madam Secretary came back this season, and she actually had Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell and Hillary Clinton on the show, and they were talking about a particular issue around terrorism. But she made a speech, the Madam Secretary, the woman playing Madam Secretary, made a speech to the nation about the difference between nationalism versus patriotism. And I think that is really an important discussion. Nationalism isolates us, and it says we're the best. We're number one.
I know.
But patriotism looks at the values of our country and the values that we built this nation on. And that is where we need to stand. America the beautiful, God shed thy grace on thee. Give me a break. Where is the grace in our politics right now?
You're going to have me in tears.
I know. We need to be back to the tears level. Well, we need to look back at our values.
We need to move into NPR. Thank you so much for your call and your insights. I'll suggest to John Orr that he keeps this ball rolling. I think it's an important topic. Thanks for your call. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned for 6 minutes of news from NPR.